Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Austrian and Hungarian law enforcement officials say several people have been arrested in connection with the discovery of 71 bodies of migrants found in a truck trailer on an Austrian highway near the border with Hungary. Austrian officials said three people were arrested, two Bulgarians and a Hungarian. Austrian police say the victims, 59 men, 8 women and 4 children, are believed to have suffocated in the refrigerated truck. The UNHCR say more than 300,000 refugees and migrants have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean this year, trying to reach Europe. Storm warnings are out for more than a dozen Caribbean islands as Tropical Storm Erica approaches after killing at least 4 in Dominica. Crews are searching for several people reported missing on Dominica, where Erica soaked the island with 38 centimeters of rain. Flooding from the torrential rains washed out roads and down power lines, cutting off electricity across the island. Forecasters say Erica likely will hit the Virgin Islands, the Dominican Republic, and the Leeward Islands Friday and Saturday. U.S. forecasters say Erica could strengthen into a hurricane and strike the east coast of Florida by Monday. Key U.S. stock indexes posted modest losses in Friday's midday trading following a week of wild price swings in global markets. The Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P 500 slid around 0.3%. Major European stock indexes were mixed at the close. European shares made big gains the previous day. Asian markets mostly rose, with Japan's Nikkei index up 3% at the close, while Shanghai advanced a strong 4.8%. This is VOA News. As U.S. officials head to Israel to try to calm fears surrounding the Iran nuclear deal, some analysts say Israel is preparing for greater involvement in the war in neighboring Syria. But as VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo, analysts say it's not just Iran, the Iran deal, which is making Israel nervous.
Kamal Abdallah, a researcher at Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo, says Israel is preparing for what it anticipates will be a greater threat coming from across its Syrian border as Iran sheds economic sanctions in exchange for curbing its nuclear program. But Labib Kamhawi, a Jordan-based political analyst, says militant groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra Front are increasingly a greater threat to Israel.
At the end of the day, a lot depends on where these forces are and how strong they are.
Some analysts say Israel's fear is unfounded because Iran will use released funds to rebuild its economy, not entrench itself deeper into the war in Syria. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Pakistan's military says unprovoked cross-border shelling from India has killed at least 6 civilians and wounded 46 more. An official statement said Friday 22 women were among those wounded. Indian media quote border officials on their side as saying that 3 civilians were killed, 16 injured in the pre-dawn unprovoked, heavy, and indiscriminate shelling by Pakistan in the area. The border officials say that India has appropriately retaliated. Border security forces of India and Pakistan have been intermittently trading fire in the area for months, with mostly civilian casualties on both sides. The skirmishes also have forced thousands of villagers in both countries to flee to safety. A teenager in the U.S. state of Virginia has been sentenced to 11 years in prison for conspiring to provide material support and resources to the Islamic State group. A U.S. Justice Department statement Friday described 17-year-old Ali Shukri Amin as a young American who used social media to provide material support to IS and said his prison sentence will be followed by a lifetime of supervised release and monitoring of his internet activities. Social media giant Facebook said it reached an unprecedented milestone this week, with 1 billion people using the site in a single day. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg praised the accomplishment in a posting on the social media site Thursday. On Monday, 1 in 7 people on Earth used Facebook to connect with their friends and family, he said. Facebook is the world's largest social network, with 1.5 billion monthly active users. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Refugee Agency reports deaths are soaring as refugees and migrants cross the Mediterranean Sea in record numbers in a desperate bid to reach European countries.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir orders all government troops to stop fighting with rebel forces and to remain in their barracks. Muslim human rights organizations accuse Kenyan police of carrying out extrajudicial killings of terror suspects. And UN humanitarian officials say this year's El Nino weather phenomenon could lead to heavy rainfall in the Horn of Africa as early as mid-September. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Sudan President Salva Kiir has ordered all government troops to stop fighting with rebel forces and to remain in their barracks. A presidential spokesman announced the executive order ahead of tomorrow's full ceasefire. The spokesman says the order permits troops to fire only in self-defense. The ceasefire is officially set to take effect at sunset on Saturday. Under threat of sanctions, Mr. Kiir signed a negotiated ceasefire agreement on Wednesday. However, he said he had serious reservations about some of the terms of the agreement. Rebel leader Riek Machar signed the deal last week. Fighting in South Sudan has displaced more than 2 million civilians. The UN Refugee Agency reports deaths are soaring as refugees and migrants are crossing the Mediterranean Sea in record numbers in a desperate bid to reach European countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 300,000 refugees and migrants have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean this year, trying to reach Europe. This is a huge increase over the 219,000 who made the crossing during the whole of 2014. Meanwhile, some 2,500 refugees and migrants have died or gone missing. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says this death toll does not include those who lost their lives Thursday when their boats capsized off the coast of Libya. She says the number of deaths in that incident is still unconfirmed.
The survivors were taken to shore. We're hearing media reports that there are about 100 survivors. Our office in Libya is checking with the Coast Guard and has not gotten the details yet. We believe 200 are still missing, feared dead.
Fleming says another horrifying incident occurred Wednesday that highlights the methods used by smugglers who cram people into unseaworthy vessels for profit. She says rescuers who came to the aid of a boat off Libya found 51 people had died from suffocation in the hold. Survivors said the smugglers were charging money to passengers just to let them come out and breathe.
One survivor, his name was Abdel, he's 25 years old from Sudan, told our colleagues we didn't want to go down there, but they beat us with sticks to force us. We had no air, so we were trying to get back up through the hatch and breathe through the cracks in the ceiling. But other passengers were scared that the boat would capsize, so they pushed us back down and beat us too.
The cost of breathing is very high. Fleming says an orthopedic surgeon from Iraq said he paid 3,000 euros to get his wife and young son on the top deck. She notes most of the people confined to the hold were from sub-Saharan Africa who could not pay that price. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, three suspects have been arrested in Hungary on charges of smuggling 71 migrants who were found dead in Austria this week. The decomposing bodies were discovered by police who noticed fluids seeping from an abandoned refrigerated truck. It was found alongside a major highway leading to Vienna. Austrian officials say the migrants probably suffocated even before the truck left Hungary. Many of the dead are believed to be Syrian refugees. Hungarian authorities say two of the trafficking suspects are Bulgarian and the third holds Hungarian papers. Hungarian authorities say they have detained more than 700 suspects on charges of human smuggling so far this year. The number of suspects detained last year was more than 500. It indicates human traffickers have been working this land route to Europe for some time. Muslim human rights organizations have accused Kenyan police of carrying out extrajudicial killings of terror suspects. The rights groups are calling for an end to the killings and for police to follow due process. Muhammad Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
48-year-old Afay Abdullahi remembers the night police officers came for him. I saw police officers harassing my neighbor. I didn't move from where I sat. Then the man told them, "There he is, the man you're looking for." Two officers came to my direction. Then one of them stuck his boot around my head. They told me to identify myself. I gave them my identification document and gave them also my phone. They blindfolded me and threw me into the waiting car. Abdullahi spent 2 days at the police station before security officers came and took him away. The Islamic school teacher says he was taken to a military camp near his village in Wajir County, where he was tortured. Two officers started beating me up. One will cane and the other will kick me, and blood will come out. They demanded I tell them whereabouts of Al-Shabaab and if I know any member. I told them I didn't know anything about them. I'm a disabled man and a Quran teacher. After 3 weeks in captivity, Abdullahi was released without charge or trial. But his brother, who was also tortured in the next room, is still missing. Hundreds of miles away in the capital, Nairobi, some Muslims gathered outside a mosque after Friday prayers to condemn extrajudicial killings and disappearances of terror suspects and Kenyan youths accused of criminal activities. Alamin Kimathi, the chairman of the Muslim Human Rights Forum, says human rights violations are rampant.
Just in three counties, we had over 220 people dead. But that is very conservative, because in one county, Wajir, we found mass graves. How many other mass graves are there? We don't even have the forensic capability in the Republic of Kenya to assess bodies.
Kenyan security forces have repeatedly denied killing terror suspects or making them disappear. However, Francis Sakwa, a human rights activist who joined the gathering, does not believe the police. He called for an end to the killings.
We as young people, we are focused in developing this country rather than focusing in rotting in jails and in custodies.
Abdullahi in Wajir is still searching for his brother. No one has given him an answer whether his brother is dead or alive. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
UN humanitarian officials say this year's El Nino weather phenomenon could lead to heavy rainfall in the Horn of Africa as early as mid-September. El Nino is a prolonged warming of the Pacific Ocean surface. It can lead to heavier rainfall in most parts of the Greater Horn of Africa and elsewhere, while also resulting in less rainfall in some areas. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization warns of possible flooding along the Juba and Chebeli rivers and flash floods in central regions of Somalia. It also says El Nino could worsen drought conditions in northern Somalia. In 2006, El Nino-related flooding affected some 440,000 people in Somalia, and in 1997 and 98, flooding affected 900,000 people. On Monday, the last known Ebola patient in Sierra Leone was released from a hospital. If the country goes 42 days without a new case, it will be declared Ebola-free. But many are still facing trauma in connection with the crisis, especially those who buried the bodies of Ebola victims. Nina DeVries has more from the capital, Freetown.
When Ebola was at its peak a year ago and there wasn't enough manpower, corpses would sometimes be left for days before being picked up. The images of decomposed bodies began to haunt burial worker Abubakar Kaloka after he joined the Red Cross.
You become nervous, you see. Sometimes you sit alone thinking what is going to happen tomorrow, because tomorrow is going to be another day. You see, the work is not easy.
All burials in Sierra Leone must be done by teams wearing protective gear to prevent the Ebola virus from spreading from the deceased to the living. Seeing people killed by Ebola day in and day out was daunting for the burial teams. Some even turned to drugs and alcohol to cope. To ease their burden, the International Federation of the Red Cross brought in psychosocial experts to administer psychological first aid. One method they taught burial members to do was to use comedic skits, song, and dance to ease stress. Team members perform for each other.
So if we say, that's the day, so let me gladify the color. Sayo, gladify, sayo, sayo, sayo.
Through this, the teams are able to decompress, says another burial team member, Tamba Musa.
When they come, they see these sort of dances, these funny things, it makes them forget the day's trauma, the day's trouble they've gone through.
Joshua Abiose Duncan is a coordinator for the Mental Health Coalition of Sierra Leone. The coalition, created in 2011, strives to make sure that mental health professionals are available in every district in the country. For the Ebola response, the coalition also worked with government and international partners on mental health issues. This included teaching people how to provide psychosocial support for each other in communities. Counseling will need to continue after the country is Ebola-free, says Duncan, but he worries there may not be enough people with specific training to help.
We need to improve the capacity of our members. Psychologists. I only know of one Sierra Leonean psychologist. And for me, that is a challenge. Professional counselors. We need more of them. We need more of individuals that could provide service with regards issues of this kind.
Yeah, there's only one psychiatrist in the country, too. And there's 6 million people in Sierra Leone and so many affected by Ebola, he says. It's simply not enough. Nina DeVries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan President Salva Kiir orders all government troops to stop fighting with rebel forces. The UN Refugee Agency reports deaths are soaring as refugees and migrants are crossing the Mediterranean Sea in record numbers in a desperate bid to reach European countries. And Muslim human rights organizations accuse Kenyan police of carrying out extrajudicial killings of terror suspects. And for more news and information, visit our website at www.voanews.com. A new study says African women are at much greater risk of domestic abuse if they are in a polygamous marriage or their husbands are alcoholics. The research was conducted in four countries and includes other abuse risk factors. It shows that education and employment are not much of a safeguard against spousal abuse. VOA's David Arnold reports.
Christabel Asieru is one of three American academics who conducted studies to determine what marital conditions contribute to domestic violence in Africa. She's an associate professor of sociology at Louisiana Tech University.
We just purposely selected the countries because they do represent countries from different regions, part of sub-Saharan Africa. So we have Zimbabwe, Malawi, Kenya, and Ghana, and they represent western, southern, central parts of Africa.
Asieru says the countries were chosen to represent the variety of African experiences.
So even though Africa tends to be painted with a broad brush, they're very different because they're very different cultures.
Researchers studied the number of wives in the marriage, whether the husband or wife suffers from alcoholism, the wife's level of education or employment, whether they live in a city or a rural area. They also considered the age difference and the ability of the wife to make major financial decisions. Asieru says polygamy turned out to be the major risk factor. In Kenya, Women who share the same husband are three times more likely to be beaten by their husbands. In Ghana, the risk factor is more than 1.5 times higher. Alcoholism ranked high, too. Women with alcoholic husbands were almost three times more likely to suffer abuse in Malawi. The numbers are only slightly higher in three other countries. Asieta describes other factors and how they compare to the other three countries in the study.
In Ghana, women were about 1.6 times more likely to experience physical violence. In another country like Kenya, they were about twice more likely. Another factor was alcoholism. In Ghana, married women whose husbands were alcoholic were about three times more likely to experience physical violence compared to a country like Kenya, where they were about twice more likely. There were some other interesting factors things for Ghana. In terms of area of residence, in Ghana, married women who were living in urban areas were twice more likely to experience physical violence, whereas, you know, that did not make any difference in some of the other countries. In terms of employment of women, that wasn't a significant risk factor of Ghana, and so it didn't really make any difference if they were employed or not. When it came to women's autonomy, making decisions on large household purchases, in Ghana, this factor wasn't significant, but it was for the other three countries. So, for example, you know, in Ghana, women with primary education or less were five times more likely to experience abuse than those with college degrees.
In an earlier piece of research, Christabel Asieta reported another crucial factor in the risk of violence in a marriage. That is, how far away the bride moves from her family or clan when she weds. That study also was conducted in Ghana.
In Ghana, what I found was that women in matrilineal, you know, areas in Ghana had a lower rate of intimate partner violence because of the support that they got from the extended family. And living in an urban area, one is less likely to be closer to extended family and therefore will not have that much support.
Based on her research, Asieru has this to say to young women from Ghana or any other African country who are about to become brides.
Based on the research, it's quite clear that you don't want to be in a polygamous union. And it makes a lot of sense because, you know, there is more conflict in some ways in polygamous unions and in terms of the power that women would have over their relationship. Polygamy puts women at a higher risk of violence. So I would say, you know, for women, for young women, that they should find some sort of work or some sort of education so that before they get married, they would, you know, be in a better position to make decisions and to be able to have more say in their relationship.
Asieru says this research is only the beginning of much-needed study of domestic abuse and of women's empowerment in Africa. This is David Arnold at VOA in Washington.
Well, Africa is host to half the world's 16 species of vultures, and while they may not be the planet's handsomest birds, these powerful creatures serve a vital function in Africa's ecosystem. They help prevent the spread of diseases from animal carcasses to humans. However, Africa's once numerous vulture populations are threatened. Darcy Ogata is the Peregrine Fund's Assistant Director of Africa Programs. She spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips about the importance of the birds.
So they make their living sort of cleaning up after mankind and livestock. And in that sense, they provide a key ecosystem service to people worldwide.
Why are they providing a service? I mean, why not, in terms of the big picture of nature, just let a corpse rot where it lies?
Yeah, so vultures are the most highly adapted scavengers, and they eat more of the dead animals than any other organism. They're very good at what they do, and they find carcasses quicker than other animals, whereas if you get a bunch of, say, feral dogs at a carcass, they're going to take longer to find it. They're going to be having a lot of contact with each other at the carcass, and dogs are notorious for spreading diseases like rabies. So one of the key factors in why vultures are so important is because their stomachs are also highly adapted. They have a very low pH, So basically, if they're ingesting any toxins or other organisms such as the rabies virus, when they're defecating, that virus is no longer viable. So in a sense, vultures are eliminating those diseases that could be found at carcasses with basically any other scavenger. You have a much higher chance of disease transmission. We also have species of vultures that are cleaning up organic waste in garbage dumps in towns and things, and they're also providing a huge service, you know, to the populations there.
So they get in a really bad rap, it sounds like.
Yeah, of course. Basically, they're portrayed as the greedy birds, and they're right up there with hyenas in terms of rather despised species. Although I have to say, you know, probably the majority of Africans know that vultures do a lot of good for the environment.
I understand that a lot of these vultures are being poisoned, not directly, but indirectly, and therefore endangered. How does that work?
Yes. The vultures in Africa have declined on average 63% over the last 30 years, and the declines are being felt across every species. Generally, what's happening, especially in East Africa, is the vultures are unintentional victims when a livestock farmer laces a carcass. It's generally a very highly toxic pesticide to kill a predator. Generally, it's a hyena or a lion, sometimes a leopard as well. And then what happens is the vultures, because they are social feeders, they come in and feed on that carcass in their tens or even hundreds. And so you will get well over 100 vultures that can be killed at a single carcass, whereas the actual perpetrator of that event is maybe a single hyena or one or two lions. It's a very disproportionate number of vultures that are being killed as a result. As you mentioned earlier, vultures are not the most glamorous or loved creatures. So, and I think with all the other social and economic issues that we have in Africa, the best way that we have to reach governments who have the power to actually change the situation for vultures here is to speak about the economic aspect of vultures, in particular, their importance to humans. So that's really what we're talking about when we try and go out and spread the message. We need tighter regulations on these pesticides so that they're not easily available over the counter. They're not as cheap as they are, and there's sort of a registrar of people who are buying them in the amounts so that misuse can be more easily traced and then perpetrators prosecuted. Of course, all of us who study vultures think they're wonderful. If you've ever watched up close a group of vultures at a carcass, they are by far the most charismatic and just amazing group of birds that you'll ever see, because they're there and they're, you know, let's say there's 70 birds at a zebra carcass or something, and they are making noise. They are bashing each other over the head because, you know, they're obviously competing for this food source and there's so many of them. Another reason why they're such cool birds is they are ranging over huge areas. While we might see a bird in Kenya, tomorrow it could be in Tanzania or South Sudan or Ethiopia. So, you know, so it definitely has to be an international effort to conserve these birds because of the huge distances they travel. It's unfortunate that they get such a bad stereotype. They're actually amazingly cool birds that have not been given their proper due.
That was Darcy Ogata, the assistant director of the Peregrine Funds Africa program. She spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa. This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan President Salva Kiir orders all government troops to stop fighting with rebel forces and to remain in their barracks. The UN Refugee Agency reports deaths are soaring as refugees and migrants are crossing the Mediterranean Sea in record numbers in a desperate bid to reach European countries. And Muslim human rights organizations accuse Kenyan police of carrying out extrajudicial killings of terror suspects. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon and our future reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, once again, I understand you are starting with World Athletics.
Kim, after 7 days of competition, Kenya remains on top of the medals table at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. The Kenyan team has tallied 6 gold, 3 silver, and 2 bronze for a total of 11 medals. The United States is in second place with 4 gold, 4 silver, and 6 bronze for a total of 14 medals. Remember, VOA sports fans, while the Americans have more total medals, the Kenyans have more gold, which carry more weight in the standings. The USA won its 4th gold medal Friday in the women's long jump. Tiana Bartoletta won her 2nd world title, with a gold medal-winning leap of 7.14 meters, the best distance by a woman this year. In other action, Chinese fans cheered at the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing when Hong Lu won gold in the women's 20-kilometer race walk in a dramatic photo-finish victory over Zhu Zilu. Both Chinese women were timed in 1 hour, 27 minutes, and 45 seconds. In other results Friday, Dutch sprinter Daphne Schippers won the gold in the women's 200 meters race, clocking 21.63 seconds. Daphne's time is a Dutch national record, a European record, and a world championship record. Earlier at the world championships, Daphne won a silver medal in the women's 100 meters race. In Friday's 2 other finals in Beijing, Russia's Sergei Shubenkov won gold in the men's 110-meter hurdles, clocking 12.98 seconds. That's a Russian national record. And Jamaica's Danielle Williams was crowned world champion in the women's 100-meter hurdles. Danielle's time of 12.57 seconds is a personal best. The 15th IAAF World Championships in Athletics will wrap up after action on Saturday and Sunday. On Saturday, Jamaican star Usain Bolt will be on the track once again, bidding for a record-extending 11th, count them, 11th World Championship gold medal. The Lightning Bolt is scheduled to run as part of Jamaica's 4x100-meter relay team on Thursday. Bolt blazed to his record 4th consecutive world 200-meter title, clocking 19.55 seconds, the fastest time in the world this year. Speaking to reporters after the race, Bolt had this to say.
I'm here to show the world that I'm the best I want to be, undoubtedly one of the greatest sprinters ever to have ever competed in this sport, and that's my aim. I have 2 more seasons to go, and I'll just continue winning and dominating. I think I'm already a legend. I've proved to the world it's just adding to my legendary status now. If I want to be among the greats, I have to continue winning till I retire, and that's my aim, and that's what I want to do.
That's the Lightning Bolt, Usain Bolt, speaking at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China.
I'm Lightning Bolt. I'm not flash guarding anybody. My name is Lightning Bolt.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
They're playing basketball without that basketball.
South Sudan-born basketball star Luol Deng of the Miami Heat has made a special visit to our Voice of America headquarters. I had a chance to talk with the two-time NBA All-Star, and I asked him, Lou, what brings you to Washington?
I'm actually here for a peace event that we put in together, South Sudan Unite. There's a lot of things going on from my homeland, South Sudan, and just trying to bring everyone together for a better future.
You were recently in South Africa for the NBA's first ever game on the continent in Johannesburg. Talk about the atmosphere there. What was that like?
No, it was amazing. We had a great, great turnout. We had people from all over Africa fly in. The game meant so much to all those people who try to do so much for the game, try to get the youth involved. The game was also huge for the whole continent. The game was broadcast everywhere. Everywhere that I went after South Africa, everyone has seen the game. It was just a proud moment for everybody. And I can't thank the NBA enough for really putting everything together and making it happen. It's been a dream of mine and a dream of so many African players to play in the continent. So that was amazing.
One African player now retired, but next month, real big honor, Dikembe Mutombo. He will officially enter the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Your thoughts on the Congolese giant?
You know, every time anyone says the name Mutombo, the first thing you do is smile. It's really amazing because he's just, he's been a great example for the continent, a great human being. He's just been teaching all of us a lot of things, all the young basketball players. And I haven't even spoke about, you know, what he's done on the court. Everything that really he stands for. He's done a great job of just showing everyone in the whole wide world who he really is without the basketball. And just like you said, he's that good to be, you know, a Hall of Famer. And that's something that, you know, going to be remembered for a long time.
Do you view him as maybe a role model in terms of your own humanitarian work?
No, of course. Of course. I mean, I can't sit here and say I haven't, you know, seen what he's done or haven't heard about it. And I think all those things affect you. All those positive things makes you, you know, one day want to just do similar things that he's done. And he's just been so great and so active in putting the continent out there and letting everyone know what's going on. And at the same time, spending time and putting people together in order to do something great to help others. So he's definitely a role model.
You entered the NBA when you were a teenager, and now you're getting ready for, I think, your 13th season. Yeah. You're one of the league's most experienced players. Have you accomplished all your goals, or you think you still have a few left to check off?
Well, I started early, so I just turned 30, so I think I still have a lot of years ahead of me. So there's a lot that I want to accomplish before I finish. I think I just the main things that I focus on is how good can I be. I think every year I push myself to try to see how much better I could get. I think at the end I just have to be, you know, look at myself and say I gave it everything I can, and that's all you can do.
What do you think of Miami's chances this coming season?
I'm really excited. I think that, you know, as a player, you always want to be honest with yourself and with your teammates. And, you know, you always look at the team and see what kind of chances that you have. And as a competitor, you always every year think you have a chance. But I really mean it this time when I say that we really have a great team, a great starting five and a great bench. I think that, you know, you go into the season with a lot of confidence. So it's going to be an exciting year.
That South Sudan-born basketball star, Luol Deng, looking forward to an exciting year with the Miami Heat Club. And Lou was talking with me at our VOA studios here in Washington. The 30-year-old Deng played his first 10 seasons in the NBA with the Chicago Bulls. He then played about half an NBA season, or 40 games, with the Cleveland Cavaliers before moving to Miami last season. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see some nice photos of me with Luol Deng during his first visit to our Voice of America headquarters. We gave Deng a brief tour of our studios before the interview, and I told him about some of the various languages we broadcast in, especially in Africa. I asked Lou what languages are spoken in South Sudan, and Deng answered English, Arabic, Swahili, as well as some local dialects. Now let's take a short break for this important message from one of Luol Deng's role models, the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net. Thanks to Kembe. And this reminder for our VOA basketball fans, on September 11th in the eastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts, Dikembe Mutombo will be officially inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Tunisia will host Angola, and Senegal will go against Nigeria in Saturday's semifinals at the African Men's Basketball Championship. The two winners will advance to Sunday's final in Rodez, just outside the Tunisian capital, Tunis. And the winner of that game will be Africa's representative at next year's Olympic men's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In quarterfinal results Thursday, Tunisia topped Mali 67-60, Senegal beat Algeria 75-58, Angola defeated Egypt 83-63, and Nigeria easily beat Gabon 88-64. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a new survey in Malawi forecasts that many people will face acute food shortages this year due to low yields of maize. And Zimbabwe's former finance minister joins a growing list of people calling for abolition of the death penalty. First, here's Jean-Pierre Simmons of Cameroon with Change in My Life.
Change in my mind. Buy a lot of things. Oh, I have change in my mind. Oh, I
Jean-Pierre Simmons with Change My Life. Well, an agricultural production survey in Malawi forecasts that many people face acute food shortages this year due to low yields of maize or corn, the country's main staple. The decline is largely because of recent flooding. Private traders are holding maize in anticipation of selling it at higher prices during the hunger period. But as Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre, the government is asking Malawians not to panic.
Malawi's Agriculture Minister Alan Chembekeza presented the report's findings in the capital, Lilongwe.
The results show that maize production has decreased from 3,978,123 metric tons that were realized in the 2013-2014 agriculture season to 2,898,123 metric tons in the current agriculture season. This represents 27.7%.
The new government statistics show that more than 200,000 Malawians are expected to face an acute food situation. Another report released at this year's Southern African Development Community Summit in Botswana put the number of Malawians at risk of hunger at over 1 million. Private traders have now started holding their maize stocks in anticipation of selling at higher prices during the peak of the hunger crisis. Fresh Aligoya is a maize trader in Chirimba Township in Blantyre. We can say the maize is scarce, he says, adding that they have the maize but are holding it because of the hunger threats. They want to sell it later. Malita Musa, a single mother of Chiwabon Township, told VOA she has started keeping maize husks ready for the impending shortage. In the past, we used to sell the maize husks to the millers right at the maize mill who were reselling them as animal feeds, she says. But now they are taking to home to keep because it will help them have food during the hunger situation. Anne Chilanga operates Elestra at the Blanda Free Market, which largely sells Nsima, a thick starchy porridge made from maize flour. She says the maize shortage will have a negative impact on her business. Reverend Felix Maulana is the chairperson for the National Food Reserve Agency. He told the privately owned Capital Radio last week the government is importing maize.
We are procuring maize now, about 50,000 metric tons, and so therefore, of leaf. But even after leaf, we have about 35 metric tons ready for anything.
He also said the National Grain Marketer, the Agriculture Development and Marketing Corporation, is also importing 30,000 metric tons from Zambia. But Rafiki Hajjat of the think tank Institute for Policy Interaction told VOA that past experience show that maize imports are not necessarily a means of averting a hunger situation.
We had a drought situation here in 99 and the year 2000, 42,000 people died, not because there was no maize, but because the price of maize was inflated by over 100% and they couldn't afford the maize.
Chairperson for the Parliamentary Committee on Agriculture, Felix Jumbe, told VOA the government should have first bought and depleted the maize stocks from local traders who are holding the maize before it started importing. Doing so, he said, would have helped prevent the impending price increases of maize. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Former Zimbabwe Finance Minister Tendai Biti has joined a growing list of people calling for abolition of the death penalty. The country's new constitution abolished mandatory death sentences and limited the death penalty to cases of murder committed in aggravating circumstances. The new law bars death sentences for women and men under 21 and over 70 at the time of committing the crime. Biti, who is now a prominent lawyer, says current death row inmates should be pardoned.
There are about 120 people that are on death row. There are so many that the normal prison that is designed specifically to cater for death row prison, Harare Central Prison, can't cater. So there's been an overflow of death row prisoners, and about 20 of them are now located at Chikurubi Prison.
You are taking interest in these death row prisoners. What exactly do you want to be done?
Well, I'm a human rights activist, and I don't believe in capital punishment. So I've taken it upon myself with others, the duty to try and save as many of them as possible using the law. So I've got three cases that are pending right now. One group is the one that says making people wait for so long on death row without executing them amounts to cruel and inhuman treatment, which is an infringement of Section 53 of the Zimbabwean Constitution. The second round of cases that I've brought is to say that the new constitution in Section 48 says there's a right to life. The new constitution then says a law may be passed that may provide for death penalty in aggravated circumstances. That law has not been passed. So I'm now saying that anyone to be executed now can be executed, but that law that is envisaged by the constitution in Section 48(2) is not there. The third interesting case which I'm trying to do, and this one I'm really, really interested in, I'm representing this chap called Obadiah Makoni. He killed his girlfriend, whom he found in flagranto 20 years ago, and he was convicted of murder. But because of age, he was sentenced to life. So I'm trying to argue that a life sentence does not mean life. Life doesn't mean life. And that an irreducible sentence of life imprisonment with no prospect of release either on parole or on pardon is not constitutional.
That was prominent Harare lawyer and former finance minister Tendai Biti speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. Or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.